Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Eric G. from the Northeast Group.
First, I want to apologize for running a little late. You know, I like to show up like an hour before the meeting starts. I like to meet the people in the meeting and all. And, but what happened was I have this 2-year-old son that I've been blessed enough to raise since he left the hospital alone. And during the men's process, I have an older daughter who was going to watch him for me tonight. Now, the dilemma was I needed to leave by 6:15. She got off of work at 6 o'clock and wouldn't be home till 6:30. So I had this half hour that I had to figure out, and it was just driving me crazy. Eventually, I would convince this teacher to take him home, you know. But I'm talking to my daughter on the phone, and she's like, "Well, Dad, well, why you got to go all the way to Quakertown? Can we get somebody from Quakertown to speak tonight?" I said, "But Shauna, they asked me to come out and give a message tonight." She said, but Dad, what difference does it make?" And when she said that, it reminded me of the story of the jogger who jogs on the beach every morning. And every morning as he's jogging, there's an older gentleman on the beach and all of the fish that wash ashore. The older gentleman's taking one fish at a time and throwing it back into the ocean. And on this one particular day, the jogger, he's running, and sure enough, the old guy's out there, and he's throwing the fish back into the ocean, one fish at a time. And the jogger happened to stop the older gentleman and ask him, "Hey, man, like, why are, it's a million fish on shore. Like, why are you standing here throwing one fish back in the ocean at a time?" And the older gentleman picked up another fish and he threw it into the ocean and he looked at the jogger and he said, "If you was that fish, it'd make all the difference in the world." Mm-hmm. And that's what you guys have done for me. You have made a difference that the medical community couldn't make. The religious institution couldn't make a change in my life. It's not until I land in your hands that I see a dramatic difference in the way I see the world. I'll be forever grateful for that. And I'm brought up under the tutelage that I've taught to suit up and show up. So I'm here tonight. My name is Eric G and I'm an alcoholic. I like to thank my traveling road team over here. You know, I suffer from severe sleep apnea, and I would not be able to make a lot of these engagements if it wasn't for these guys. And these guys arrange their schedules to make sure that, you know, and we have a great time coming. And I had, like, I was real cool, calm, and collective, and I was like, "Hey, I'm going to hammer this talk, and then I'm going to go home." And then Ron's here just threw me straight off course, and now I'm trying to, like, get myself back together, because, you know, I'm here. I understand my purpose tonight, you know, and my purpose is to let y'all know, like, what it was like, what happened, and how things are now, and, I need to say that, like, you know, when I say, like, the religious community had tried to change me, I mean, they really did. And, like, you know, I'm brought up in an area where, like, the parents believed and it took a village to raise a child. So, like, the community raised kids. So my mom had, like, 30 girlfriends, and they sat out front all the time. And as my alcoholism progressed, then I was very young when I hit my first rehab. I was 17, and as my alcoholism progressed, I can remember coming in a house one day, it's like 2 weeks. I've been out 2 weeks. I'm coming. I'm dead tired, and my mom and all her girlfriends were church people. And the lights were off in the house, and I was like, "Cool, ain't nobody home." And I went and I turned on the living room light, and somebody forgot to tell these ladies that frosty emotional pills seldom suffices. Like 30 of them jumped on me. "Hallelujah, praise God," putting oil on me. And I'm like, "What is going on here?" Like, they had jumped me and hit me with this holy water. So, you know, because I'm a good alcoholic, like I said, "Hey, if I want to lessen this blah, blah, play along. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you." And I just started playing along with him, and it went on. But Yeah, but, you know, they did the best that they thought they could. They didn't understand what I was going through. I didn't understand what I was going through. I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years and didn't understand what I was going through. I didn't understand why in 90 days sober, I was trying to determine if I was going to jump in front of L's or L or not with a 90-day chip in my pocket and people telling me, hey, you're doing super. You're doing great. Keep coming back. I just didn't understand that why they were saying giving me praise that wasn't matching the way I felt on the inside. I just couldn't understand it. And if you're laying in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my mind, and you got 90-day chips in your pocket, and everybody telling you that you're doing good, and you're feeling the way I was feeling on the inside, then I just don't belong on the earth. But I just can't muster up the courage to take my life. So I started out with this idea that, you know, I'm brought up in an area where everybody cool and slick, and they talk real hip, and, everybody like to hang at the bar and get the girls and go home and do all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I figure I'd try that. You know, I was, the older guys, that's just what they did. They hung in the bar, they nursed one drink all night until they got what they wanted, went home, and it was a successful evening. I had a few problems with that idea. The first one was, you know, I always had a distorted perception of my reality, you know. None of this stuff makes me alcoholic, but I was the kid who got the hand-me-down underwear, hand-me-down drawers. My mom didn't work, and in my life, we were like the scum of the earth. I was resented at my mom for not going out and being like my friend Keith's mom, because Keith had a TV in the wall back in the early 90s. You know, I was using binoculars to look at my neighbor's TV. And my mom would never do anything to change this. I was always able to hang up everything on her. In my mind, it was her fault. I'm so selfish. I'm so selfish in the way I see things is that when I know that I'm stepping on somebody's foot, when they say something to me about it, and my rebuttal is, why do you keep putting your foot under mine? And this is how I move through life. So I'm able, my mom gives me an outlet to hang all my stuff up on in my mind because she's just not a good mom. And I walk around, I've always taught myself to feel less than. You know, page 23 kind of comes and says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. Right, and I'm a firm believer that I walk around with this distorted perception, these self-defeating ideas. And when I land at the bar and I try to be like the older gentleman and I take the first drink, because it was my first drink that did something for me. It didn't take a long time. My first drink removed all that stuff I thought about the world, about my mom, about how we was living. I hear a lot of people say, hey, you know, first did something to me, then did something for me. It did something for me from the drive. Because I know that, you know, my goal, once I formed the relationship with alcohol, was to escape reality whenever I could. Any opportunity I got, I wanted to be gone. And I would stay in the bar and I would nurse these drinks. You know, I would... Let me rephrase. I would attempt to nurse one drink like the older gentleman, but it never worked out that way. And it was from the start that I didn't know that I would be waking up on benches, that I would be at people's houses that I didn't know when I came to. It was from the start that when I planned a Saturday night, okay, I'm going to go out this Saturday night. Get me a hot chick. I'm going to come on, have some Chinese food, and I'm going to come on home. You know, it's when I began planning my evenings with my new love affair with alcohol that I would go out, and the only part of the Saturday night that went right was the planning part. Because by the time I got to the bar, I didn't know what the outcome would be. And normally it ended like this 4 days later. Ring, it's my mom's phone. Hello, this is a free call from the Philadelphia prison system. Please press 5 to answer. And that's how it turns out for a guy like me. It's not that stuff doesn't make me alcoholic because I get arrested. That's just a result of what happens when I drink. You know, you don't have to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to go out on a night of drinking and get arrested. So let's be clear about that. I could stop drinking. Best believe me, I went broke a few times and I had no other alternative but to stop drinking. But the problem lies in trying to live without it. And I didn't really get that until I started hanging out with you guys. I thought that, like, you know, once I stopped, that, like, the alcohol was out of my system, I could think clearer, that, you know, I would make firmer decisions. But I did not realize is that when I'm sober, that I'm really dealing with my problem. And I'm not getting it. What I'm really not getting is, and I don't get this to the end, so right before I walk through your door, but along the way, I don't really realize that all my folks are on the receiving end of my decisions, and it just ain't looking good, but I'm able to minimize it by saying, oh, they understand I'm drinking. I know I'm doing harm. I know they hurt, but I try to minimize it in any kind of way that I can, because I really, and guess what? In all honesty, I didn't even understand the validity of what I was doing to them people. You know, our book talks about it, right? It engulfs the life of anybody who touches the sufferer, right? It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, and financial insecurity. And I don't know that I'm doing this. You know, I don't know that people are pitching pennies to try to satisfy my needs. I don't know that my sisters and brothers are developing resentments because they're watching our mom decompose as a result of worrying about me and my bad decision making. I don't know that none of this going on. Now, like what my friend Chris B says, he says, one symptom of delusion is that while you're experiencing it, you don't know you're in it. And that rings true. And I know this, and I come across situations where I'm totally sober, and I go to these delusional states, and I believe that they're so true, and when I come out of them, I start classifying myself as some kind of homicidal maniac, because only people who should be locked away forever think the way that I think. I'm talking about totally sober. There was a time when, and you know, I'm a really good alcoholic, so that's why she's my ex-wife. So it was me and my ex-wife, and, you know, we thought that, well, we didn't think anything. She never drank in her life, but I still believe that, like I said, it engulfs the lives of anybody who touches sufferer. I infected her with some of this in some kind of way, and while I get to escape with a drink, she don't get to do nothing. She got to live with it, right? So, there was a time we got married, and I thought that if we bought a house in middle-class neighborhood, you know, we would be, you know, I thought that we would be okay, you know. I thought, you know, that it would be like a Keep Up with the Joneses thing. We look more like Keeping Up with the Osbournes. And while the unmanageability was apparent in our house, as a result of my bad decision making, you know, and I didn't know at that time that I didn't have the ability to change my thinking without being connected to something, right? But I tried and tried again, and we just kept going down the drain. The whole family, I was pulling the whole family. It talks about building that structure only to pull it down. We'll pull it down. We get so bad, we'll build it back up. And after going through that in 10 years, she left. But the unmanageability was apparent in the house. But to the neighbors, I'm thinking they don't know what's going on. I'm a social worker. She's working at, she's a counselor at the school. And every day I'm throwing on suits. I'm jumping in a brand new Altima. I don't know that the neighbors know that, like, when people lose 70 to 80 pounds over a 3-month period of time, they kind of suspect that something's going on over there. But I'm still putting my suits on. I'm jumping in my car like nothing's going on, but we're borrowing food from our parents, borrowing money, robbing Peter, and that's the unmanageability that's going on in the house. It's not until my dad one day, I'm coming out the house, and I put my, like I just told you, I'm putting my suit on, and I'm about to get in my car, and he called me, and I knew he wanted to check me, so I act like I was in a rush. I'm like, I can't stop right now. I gotta go. And I jumped in my car, and he stood right in front of it. And then he walked around the side of the car. And I said, what's up? I'm in a rush. I rolled the window down. Hey, Dad, what's up? He said, I just want to let you know, you can put a suit on a pig. It's still a pig. And he just walked away. So the day came when my car would get repossessed. One of my greatest fears, and I didn't know I was a fear-driven person, and what I found out about my fears is a lot of times fear will drive me and land me at outcomes I'm trying to avoid. When I'm trying not to look stupid, I look stupid. I'm in an AA meeting. I don't want y'all to know that I don't know. I put my suit on. I don't want y'all to know that I don't even got a half hour, let alone 24. So I come in and I come in dressing. You ask me questions and I think I'm giving you a smart response. You got a sponsor? No, I think I'm going to give me one Friday, man, when I get paid. Did you read the doctor's opinion? Nah, man, I'm waiting on my primary care physician to call me back, man. I'm good. Because one of my greatest fears is what you think about me, right? Like the alcoholic, like to present a stage character to the world. And that's what I do, man. I do that well. And I don't want you to think that I, because, right? And my greatest fear, Eric G's greatest fear is what I think you think about me. And what you don't know at this time is that I feel like I feel like a disgrace. I feel like a letdown. I got all this stuff going on, and I don't want you to know that. And so me and my ex-wife, so the day came, they took my car. At the time, I'm working for the mayor's office of community service. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to explain to my coworkers that my car got repoed. So it happened to be raining on this day. So I had previously been in a car accident a couple years ago that I never followed through on, but I still had the apparatus. So it's me and my wife in the living room, and I come up with the idea that I'm going to put this on, and I'm going to tell my coworkers and my director that I couldn't see, and I told them my car on 95. It makes perfect sense. I go in the closet, I put on the neck brace, put on a leg brace, the arm sling, whip the crutch out, and I have my wife drive me to work. And I go in, everybody's empathetic. Oh my God, what happened? bad accident on 95. I told him my car. You did? Why are you? Yeah, and then my director happened to come out and he looked and was like, wow, what happened? And I kind of explained the story to him the same way I explained it to my coworkers. He said, listen, man, I just want you to go home. I'm going to pay you while you're home. I'm going to pay you till you get better. I said, all right. So he took me home and he let me off at the curb. And I had two crutches. And I was crutching up the steps and I opened up my front door and my wife was sitting in the living room. And I looked at her and crutched on in the house. I tell you, like when I'm in this delusional state, I don't know that I've drifted off there. And I crushed to the couch. And then I put one crutch under this arm with the other crutch. And I put my arm on the couch. And I slide down the couch. And I look over at my wife, and she's looking at me like I'm crazy. What's wrong with you? Eric, what's wrong with you? What? My back hurts from the accident. And she says, Eric, you weren't in no accident. And it's times, and that's a funny one, right? But there are times where I've come out of delusional states like that, man, and been like, wow, man, like, what's wrong with me? I have to be mental. It's more than alcohol. And this is where my psychiatric career starts, because I have to be insane. It has to be more than just drinking. And then I land in front of a psychiatrist. He said, oh, and therapist. He said, we're going to do some cognitive therapy. We're going to rearrange your thoughts. And what they don't know and I'm not aware of is rearranging my thoughts. It's like pulling the trash bag out of the trash can with intentions of taking it out, but just sitting it in the bathroom. The trash is still there. And I don't know this because I've been blaming it on alcohol, but when I come out of these delusional moments, now I'm blaming it on mental insanity, and I'm trying to figure stuff out. And I don't know that that's the biggest problem, that it's me trying to figure it out. And I continue to do this, and I mean, I swear to God, man, I done landed in front of people with more degrees than a thermometer. Couldn't fix me, man. And when you landing in these places and you're trying to figure it out, and you're willing to go to any lengths over alcoholism, and you land in the medical community, anything they give you, you're willing to take. And after a period of time, as my alcoholism progressed, I could begin to see the pain and harm I start causing. I didn't know that. I didn't know that, like, this wouldn't end with just me. There would be no way. Because, you know, I like to think that I'm a smart guy. I used to always, God rest my grandma, so I never understood why she would always refer to me as an educated fool. You're an educated fool, Eric. What do you mean? You'll find out. So I like the effect produced by alcohol. I like his co-defendants too. Anytime that I'm able to get outside of my own reality, any opportunity, I don't care if it's through whatever, tuna fish, cheese steaks, shot, anytime I'm able to get outside of myself until I can get the ultimate remedy, another drink, I'll do it. Because my reality seems so bleak. There was a point in my alcoholism where I just thought that this was the way God made me. Oh, you know what? I tried everything. This is how I'm supposed to be. And began to live as if that was true. With my idea of what I thought an alcoholic was, because I had placed myself above them. Above that group of people. Not realizing that those people are way ahead of the game because they knew they were at bottom and I didn't. And, And it really dawned on me when I decided to, the first time I decided to do, I come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous after hurting a lot of people, doing a lot of damage. Like, and what I come to find is that, like, once I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that, like, in We the Agnostics, it talks about deep down that every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Why am I missing, if God is in everybody, why am I missing these experiences? Because I have these character defects that continue to put space in between me and other people. Now, God's blocked in my life because I believe he's God, but I'm missing them opportunities of seeing them with you because my character defects put so much space in between me and my relationships that I constantly find myself in the most dangerous place I could be alone. Inside my own head. And I know now I didn't have the first kid thinking that was going to fix it. Now I'm on kid three. Things ain't got better. But this one's a girl. This has to be it. And I tell you, I love my daughter to death. I would never mention this outside this room, because y'all have a responsibility not to say what I say. But I would do stuff for that girl I wouldn't do for my boys. And I would go out the door, you know, and she already knew that, like, it'd be a minute for daddy come back, you know. There would be times where I'd be ready to walk out the door, And she could have on whatever. She was grabbing her couette to try to come with me. Because, you know why? I had instilled the fear in her that Daddy wasn't coming right back. And she didn't know when Daddy was coming back. Because Daddy's so wrapped up in what he want to do. And even when I leave out for these intervals, these 5 to 7 day intervals, like initially my ex-wife, she's calling my cell phone and in whatever establishment I'm in, as I see it, I'm doing stuff like this and then I'm trying to turn it down and then I'm accidentally answering it and then I'm turning it over and like, wherever I'm at, when it's a break in action, I kind of check my messages. Now, day 1 through 3 when I'm out, you know, my wife's calling me a bunch of highly descriptive adjectives. But around day 4 or 5, the message changed because, you know, she got unconditional love for me. And she said she would go to the bitter end with me and she would be like, I really don't care what you did. We love you. This is like day 5 out. We miss you. And then she would put my daughter on the phone. Daddy, come on. Where are you? And then my daughter would begin to talk about her day, like into my hands. And at those times, I wish I could have got up and just went home and been a good dad. But my active alcoholism prevented that. On this one occasion, I would eventually go home and, you know, it was the same routine and I would go home and, sure enough, my daughter was in the window. And when she saw me, she gave the same reaction like she just saw me 5 minutes ago, you know. And, I come up the steps and I go in the house and, my son's everybody, you know, the kids don't know. He's happy to see me, happy, like daddy's home, that's all they know. And my wife's happy too, but she's trying to, you know, she can't co-sign. So, you know, she look like she's going up the steps, like she don't care without saying nothing to me. And I'm with the kids and we playing. And, because guess what? I'm a good dad when I'm present. Another problem I have is I have no consistency in no area in my life. As a result of active alcoholism. And I'm playing with the kids, and, you know, I put the boys down. I know Shauna, my daughter, I know she's just not going to have it. She's not going to have it. And I can tell because I go upstairs, and I take a shower. My wife's in the room, I take a shower, and I try to wipe everything. I try to wash everything off me. I try to wash myself till this never happens again. And I'm in the shower for hours trying to wash whatever it is off me. And I come out, and I get dressed, and I come down the steps. And as I come down my house steps, my daughter's playing in front of the front door. And to most people, to the naked eye, it would look like it's just a little girl. She picked a spot in front of the front door. But because I know I've instilled this fear in her that I might go out that door and not come right back. So the safest thing for her to do is block the door so she's going to play by the door. And I know that I've instilled this fear in a 2-year-old. I'm not proud to say that. I'm just trying to tell you the truth about my alcoholism. As the night would go on, I would put the boys to bed, and I could hear my wife get in the shower, and I'd do what any good alcoholic do when their significant other hit the shower. I'd run upstairs, and I'd check her pocketbook, and I'd take what's left. I come zooming down the steps, but when I come halfway through the steps, because I was looking to make sure she didn't hear me, when I turn around, a power greater than me was at the bottom of the steps, my daughter Shauna with her big brown eyes. Where you going, Dad? And at that moment, she was enough to stop me on that night. She just wasn't enough to stop me completely. I got Shauna. And I told myself on that night, you know what? That's it. I'm going to be a good dad. I'm going to be a family man. I'm going to do a 360-degree turnaround. You know, I'm going to be something. I'm going to make sure my boys be something. They're going to have a happy life. Come on, Sean, let's lay down. And we laid down. My wife get out the shower. Meanwhile, I still got the money in my pocket. She gets out the shower. Me and Sean are laying on the couch. Sean is laying on my chest. We're watching Barney or whatever she want to watch because I kind of did whatever she asked me to do. My wife come downstairs, see that, like, you know, everything's calm and it appears that, like, this evening is about to end and I'm going to be there. She goes back upstairs. I knew that was her final time coming down because I know my wife and the way she think when she came down, saw what she saw again. She thought that that would be the end to the evening. Page 30 talk about conceding to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. And for a guy like me, man, that's coming to the conclusion and realization and accepting the fact that I got a mind that wants to kill me, but it'll settle for me walking around wishing I was dead. It's not that I drink too much. I can't, you know, I don't know if I would get this if I just continue to focus on how much I'm drinking. But I know for a fact that when I realize that I got this damaged brain that want to take me out or want me to always feel like I'm on the edge of going out, when I address that stuff, I begin to get better. And I say that to say because, you know, I said that, like, listen, I'm not going back out. Like, no, I know the duties of a dad. I know how to raise a family. I know all this stuff. We didn't not talk about moral convictions galore. None of this stuff works when it comes to combat alcoholism. But I think it do. I think that my daughter, the flesh of my creation is on my chest. I am back home. I should be homeless. I should not have a family. Nobody should care about me. But yet still, after the 50th, they are still behind me 100%. You know what? I'm going to play my part tonight. And we laid on the couch and showing her right before she went to sleep because, again, I didn't frighten this girl to death, man. And right before she went to sleep, she's two. She took one arm. She was laying on my chest. She took one arm, slipped it up my T-shirt, grabbed my shirt, and twisted it. She took her other arm. She put up the other side of my shirt. She grabbed it, and she twisted it, and she pulled it real close, and she became a human lock. And in her mind, she was going to get a good, nice rest knowing that her dad was in her arms. He wasn't going nowhere. And I thought it was cute as she was doing it. Baby, I'm not going nowhere. And like it don't even come up as let's go out and drink. I wonder what Anthony's doing right now. And then that thought becomes exciting to find out what Anthony's doing. And the more about alcoholism, it talks about how the insane thought always won out. You know, no matter how long I laid on that couch trying to come back, going out with, you know, all the reasons I would try to stay inside the house, the insane idea would walk out and I began to pick the human lock. I begin to take my daughter's arm and pull her from under my shirt. Every time I tried to pull one, she would readjust, regrip. I mean, it took like 20 minutes to get this girl off of me. And against my better judgment, against my will, against whatever, I would go out the door again. And I would curse God on that night. I, if this is the way you want me, please just take me out. Let whatever happen tonight, let it be the end. Like, I'm done. Like, I'm just done. I'm done. Please. I beg you. I would grab hold again, and man should put a little bit of time together, just come in and out your door. I didn't know that. And, you know, I have been at Alcoholics Anonymous since 1992. I didn't know y'all had a book till 2010. So I was just, you know, I was just like doing stuff like, you know, I thought it worked like by osmosis. Like, I hang out with Ryan, because Ryan is this concrete guy, AA, and as long as I follow behind Ryan, I'm going to be okay. Because he already established, and if I just hang out with him and mimic what he do, thank you, and mimic what he do, like, I'm going to be okay. And I don't understand how deep this problem is. Cause, you know, I don't understand that would never work. But I also don't understand, like, the quicksand that I'm in. And I'm talking about the quicksand that I'm in sober. I'm talking about the quicksand I'm in when I'm still trying to figure out solutions to this problem. What makes sense to me? And I don't know that we're entering into the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, nothing makes sense. I'm still trying to do logical stuff to fight this out, to fight this alcoholism. And I remember like being like 90 days clean, and I had a sponsor who was in the big book, and I told him, not yet, okay? Get some time under my belt. And I was about to leave my house, and my wife gave me a kiss. My ex-wife gave me a kiss, and she said, I just want my old husband back. And I would walk out the door just like thrilled, like it was my pat on the back, and I thought this was the thing that was going to send me rocking it in the right direction. And I get to the meeting and my sponsor's there, but I come late, so they sharing. But after the meeting, me and my sponsor there, because my sponsor wasn't one of them guys at that time. That guy wasn't the guy. I was like, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. He was like, what you want to do about your problem? How can I help? This is what I did. Do you want to do that? And when I said no, he was perfectly fine with it. So after the meeting, I was chatting with him, and I was like, I told him about my day like I do, you know, because my life is all about me. And at the end, I said, yeah, my wife said, she's doing, how's your wife? She's good, man. She kissed me tonight. We're doing good, man. When I walk away, she said, man, all she wants is her old husband back. He said, Eric, I need you to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He said, I need you to go back to your wife and tell her that I said, that's the guy with the problem. And I have a lot of experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, really great guys who attempted to help me, but I thought I was smarter than them. And I kind of wrote off what they would be saying. Like, that's what I'm saying. Probably along the way, I was been here since 92. Probably I know somebody say, yeah, you might want to try the big book, but I thought I was smarter than everybody, so I didn't hear it. I didn't know listening was an art, not an activity. And I will go on to find that later on after a 12-step experience. So I'm in and out of jail. I'm in and out of jail. That don't make me alcoholic, but that's what happened when I drink. I'm watching my mom decompose in front of me. She was this social butterfly. And this is at the end. At the end, I'm watching the effects of my alcoholism on other people. And this is when I really know I got a problem, because as I'm having the conversation with myself about watching my mother die before my eyes as a result of my actions and not being able to do anything to stop it on my own power, not recognizing I need to connect to something other than me, and me not being able to stop her pain, I just felt like I shouldn't be sharing the air on earth with other people. I don't know. See, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's stuff like, I know I need that. I know something needs to happen that I can't bring about the change that's necessary in my life. I know this. I just don't know where to go. And I hear this God thing, But, you know, and how it works to talk about the result was nil till we let go of our old ideas, absolutely. And what that means for a guy like me is that, like, I need to learn how to sit some stuff in the parking lot. And if I want to come back to it after a 12-step experience, then that's fine. But while I'm trying to get the program, I need this, like, my religious training. I was a Baptist. I went to church every Sunday. My mom took us to church every Sunday. So by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and y'all was talking about God, I wrote myself off because I broke all 10 commandments. That won't work for me. Then because I'm smart, I'm too smart for that I'm stupid, I would make up logical stuff like this. My arguments with myself would be, why would God help you, Eric, when it's a baby over in Children's Hospital who didn't ask to be here, that's hooked up to every machine imaginable and could possibly die, and he's not helping that baby? Why would he help you? These are my own arguments with myself. And then for real, like, I'm not a guy who really like to outsource stuff. Especially not problems. You know, I got a Pathfinder truck. I'm going on 5 years old. I got a Pathfinder truck. Something go wrong with it. I'm no mechanic. But you'll see me go on YouTube and try to fix the problem. And then a $20 problem turns into a $2,000 problem. That's how it was with my alcoholism. Everything I tried turned worse. So I'm broken now. I had just committed a crime. I'm on probation. I hadn't seen my probation officer because, you know, how the book talk about how I can't keep that important appointment. Like, you can't tell me on Monday I need to come give you a urine on Friday. You know, because I'm going to try. I'm going to attempt. But I can't keep the appointment. Because if by the time I get there on Friday, if I show up, that urine will be hotter than the 4th of July. Believe that. So I don't show up. And when you put me in front of the judge who told me that I needed to get clean urines, as he's giving me idle threats, such as, if you come back in front of me one more time, I'm going to send you upstate. As he's giving me that idle threat, I'm already trying to figure out where I'm sending my personal belongings because I know I'm going. So I committed a crime, I'm on probation, and I do what any good alcoholic do. I'm not a rehab guy, but I check in. I check in, and the first thing I do is I find out who my case manager is, and I talk to my case manager, and 15 minutes after that conversation, my case manager is on the phone with my probation officer saying I'm doing well. I managed to talk my counselor into letting me out of rehab early. It was like the 22nd of December. I'm like, I still hadn't talked to my mom. I hadn't made no amends to nobody. And I managed to have my counselor write me off and convince my probation officer that I should leave early. And so my mom said that, come over for a holiday dinner. I ain't been over there in 5 years. I need to go. What you mean you're not going to let me out and I only been here 3 days? So I convinced both of them, because I'm a good alcoholic, to let me go AWOL. And as he's writing up my paperwork, he said something very profound. He said, Eric, I don't mind letting you go, man, because you probably can run groups better than the therapist here. He said, but I want you to do something for me when you leave. I said, what? He said, I want you to find a group of guys who are living the big book. I said, oh, man, I know the big book. You don't be hearing me in meetings out there? I be calling that. I know that book back and forward. He said, no. He said, I want you to find a group of guys that are living it. And I would leave that rehab and I would be on the street for 2 days after rehab. I didn't want to go back to the house I was living at because they was getting high. I didn't want to get high anymore. and drunk. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to have a drink. I didn't want to put no harmful pollutants of any sort in my body. So I refused to go back to, and it was my house. I refused to go back there. And I'm on the street for 2 days trying to figure out what I'm going to do because I could feel it coming on and I just didn't want to go back there. I could feel it, man. And I'm in the street and I'm talking to God like I'm talking to myself and I'm leaning towards just doing what I do and then I'm on this long walk to nowhere. I'm just walking and suicide began again to look extremely attractive. And I had been at the Northeast Group since 92. In and out. Well, I'm going to say I hung out with them. I wasn't in and out. Because if you're in and out, that means you did what our program asks you to do. Because rarely have we seen a person fail and sturdily follow our path. My problem is I come in there and create paths for myself. And I didn't know why I went there, but I said the greatest prayer I ever said, God, please help me. And my feet were just directed to what we refer to as the Blue Door, the Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I opened the door, and when I opened the door, I have an immediate second. I see a miracle in progress. I opened the door to the Northeast Group, and it was this guy, Bill B., and he was carrying these bags of coffee to the coffee bar. Why is it a miracle? Because me and Bill B., we ran this recovery house together, right? And he was like the director, and I was like the coordinator. And at the end of each day, we would come in our room, and we would drink. And I would look at Bill from my bed. He gonna always be that way. He'll never get no better. And I would post stuff on Facebook, like a real spiritual quote. And Bill would go on my post, because I was so drunk, I forgot I didn't know the friend. Hey, it would go on my post, but you got a pint of whiskey over there. And like, we're only like 3 feet apart, but we're not talking. On Facebook, and I'm rude. Stay off my Facebook, you gonna muddle my message. And Bill B was taking, he was the coffee bar steward. He had a new look and his actions were different. And I stood there and I was stuck on him because something broke inside of me. Any denial, any lies I was telling myself about how this couldn't work for me, how God couldn't work for me, they were smashed in that moment because he was truly a miracle. See, God know what you need when you need it. He knew I needed tangible evidence that he would help me. He gave it to me just like that. Talked to Bill. He sat me down. He told me what he had done. He had experience. You know, he did with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Eric, it was a lot of people around that. I don't know if it was him or somebody else. He said, hey, man, third tradition. Say, man, you remember when you say you remember. And that's cool, but we 12-step members, too. And I looked up at the wall, and I'm like, man, it's just like, that just don't look like it can fix the complications I've made in my life. Like, this. I look at Bill, and at that moment, I don't even know if I believe the step would work for me, but I became willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism. I know my man Ken C. say he's six-pack Charlie out in Ohio, say, like, a moment of sanity is when God paralyzes the liar in you long enough so you can see the truth. And that's what I saw the truth on that day. And I couldn't deny it. So I would follow those guys, man. I would walk with those guys. I would eventually get a sponsor who would take me through the 12 steps and who would introduce me to this new relationship with my creator, this guy who kept me under of a philosophy that, like, you know, my main aim in life is how can I be useful? How can I be useful? He told me two things before he sponsored me. He said, we can read as many books as you want. We can talk about as many steps as you want. He said, we can go to as many meetings as you want. He said, but I got two conditions. I said, what? He said, the first condition is that the most spiritual response you can give me is okay. Eric, what are you doing? I'm here watching the Eagles, man. It's tied up. They're about to kick the field goal. Okay, put your shoes on. I'm out front. We're about to go to the last stop in Camden to see how we could be useful. Okay. Eric, what are you doing? Hey, man, watching the championship game, man. Like, Villanova winner. Okay, all right, put your shoes on. Be there in about 20 minutes, man. We're going to go downtown. We're going to feed the homeless. And it was a time where I was going through some turmoil, and I didn't know how to show you my insides, at least one person, because I was told that, like, you ain't got to let everybody know what you look like on the inside, but you better be cha-chaing with somebody. And he said, I was going through a lot. I didn't have no money. I was living in a recovery house, and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I refused to write the inventory. It was still sitting on the table, and I know that if I went through this process, I would learn how to enter this state of peace, no matter what was going on. And he called me. He said, what are you doing? I said, I ain't doing good, bro. I don't know about all this stuff. He said, that's fine. Pack a bag for your week, man. I'm going to have Greg and them come pick you up, man. We're going to the World Convention in Atlanta. I was 6 months sober, man. in Atlanta, in the Georgia Dome, holding hands with 80,000 alcoholics saying the Lord's Prayer. You're talking about a powerful moment. And I took that fourth step with me. And I begin to write it. I begin to write that inventory. And I'm a firm believer that the alcoholic don't get better until you learn how to put pen to paper. And the day came, we was going to talk about that list. Because everybody, you know, all I don't know about y'all, but I had a ball writing my resentment list. Finally, we're going to air this stuff out. First person on top of my list was my mom. I told you how horrible a mom she was. He said, you ready to talk? Who we're going to talk about first? I said, my mom. And I spent about 20 or 30 minutes talking about her. He said, hey, is that it? Are you done talking about her? I said, yeah, I think I pretty much covered everything. He said, okay. He said, Eric, I need to tell you something. Today we're not going to talk about how horrible your mom was. Today we're going to talk about how you sucked as a son. And I said, well, he kind of backdoored me because I wasn't prepared to look at me. You know, that's the last thing I want to do is look at me. And I didn't know through that process I could uncover, discover, and discard some stuff that was holding me back from this relationship. Not only because I believe that the steps fix relationships. Step 1, 2, and 3 fixes my relationship with God. 4, 5, and 6 fix relationship with myself. 7, 8, 9 fix relationship with other people. 10, 11, 12 just maintains those relationships. And I didn't know that after I came out that talk on that inventory, after I was able to shift my perception of how I saw the world, I saw the same stuff in a different way when I came out of that talk. And that's the primary reason that when I laid my head down on the pillow and I was supposed to meditate for an hour or read the stuff, make sure I didn't make that. That's the reason why when I laid my head on the pillow that night, there wasn't 10 million movies going on. I wasn't trying to keep up with 5,000 conversations. I was able to lay my head on the pillow and go straight to sleep. And I come out, I'm more willing than ever now. Something that happened, something that took place. It takes place in people in different stages. It took place in me. I was immediate ready to check out these defects because I knew. I knew that. I knew how I behaved and I knew how I put space in between me and other people. And I was ready to go straighten that stuff out. As a result of the amends that I made to my mom, that social butterfly who I believe I confined to the second floor bedroom to a twin bed is now back in the community and a member of Al-Anon as a result of what y'all did with me. the daughter who I'm grateful, Shauna, she was 2 then, she's 24 now. I made amends to her in 2016, and I had the new kid, and I didn't realize that I had left her, because even when it looked good, I'm obsessed over the new kid, and I'm going to be a good dad to the new kid, and she's around as a result of my amends process, and I'm not realizing that I left her, and I'm pushing stuff on her that she can't emotionally take, and she's snapping. When she snaps, I snap, and she leave me again. I had to do some more growing. I did some more growing, did some more talking, and as a result of that, I was walking into my office building. I walked upstairs, and the secretary downstairs said, "Eric, your daughter said, come here." Now, I know I was instructed to cut off a lot of my relationships with the other sex for various reasons, so I'm thinking, like, who went to these extremes to say that they're my daughter in my office to come see me? And I come down my steps, my office steps, and as I come down the office steps, sure enough, it's Shauna again. She said, "I turned the corner, and I saw this head walking in the building. I said to myself, oh, that's my dad." And she came in the building. She said, "I sat out there. I didn't know whether or not to come in, and I came in." Long story short, as a result of that, we spent the last 2 weekends together, and I got the opportunity to meet my grandson. One thing I never stopped doing was finding ways to be useful, no matter what went on. I was taught that no matter what, and sometimes I can get in my head, but I ask God to guide my feet. And what I come to find out is that alcoholics have this dire thirst for God and don't know it. It's like the eagle who runs around with the chicken and don't know he's an eagle. And then he finds out that he's an eagle, and then the storm comes, and every animal runs for cover when the storm comes, except the eagle. The eagle looks for the eye of the storm, and it spreads its wings and allows the wind or the voice of God to take it wherever, to the next level, to wherever it needs to be. And I think through a 12-step process, I've learned that too. I've learned how to depend on the voice of God. I've learned how to spread my wings as a result of what y'all tell me. Spread my wings and allow that voice or that wind to take me to the highest of heights. And as a result of that, a lot of folks benefit from that. And I'll be forever grateful to you guys. So will I come to Quaker Town to deliver a message? I definitely will. Why? Because it makes all the difference in the world. Thanks.